ready for our second case today. State Farm Fire and Casualty Company versus Hay Quality Water International are representing the Cincinnati Insurance Company is attorney Jason P. Gary. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. My name is Jason Gehring, and I represent petitioners Hay Quality Water International and the Cincinnati Insurance Company. I'm here today to ask this court to affirm the trial court's decision, reverse the Court of Appeals decision, and reinforce that it's proper for a trial court to focus on what risks are reasonably foreseeable to a purchaser when determining what constitutes other property under the economic loss doctrine. The facts of this case are not complex or disputed. The case involves a water softener appliance that was purchased by the plaintiff State Farm's insured and installed into a rental home as part of significant renovations. The water was packaged with a warranty that specifically did not cover incidental or consequential damages. A couple years after the product was purchased and installed, it allegedly leaked and caused damage to the home. State Farm paid for the damage to the home. Specifically, in discovery, State Farm itemized the following categories of damage as a result of the alleged water leak: cleaning, doors, drywall, electrical, heavy equipment, finished carpentry, trim work, and water extraction remediation. The trial court appropriately held that the damage was based merely on disappointed expectations of State Farm's insured, and therefore the economic loss doctrine precluded the tort claims. The Court of Appeals reversed. It held that the disappointed expectations It held as to the disappointed expectations test that the water softener did not fail to perform its function in its expected way. It held that the water softener was not expected and intended to interact with other portions of the home it damaged, and therefore the damage to other portions of the home were other property. We petitioned this court because we believe the Court of Appeals erred in its decision. First, the water softener was incorporated in the home as a fixture. It would have transferred with title the property and was part of an integrated system of the home. And that's consistent with the Bay Breeze decision and the Seltzer decision, where they both held that damage to siding of a home as a result of a faulty window was not only as a result of disappointed expectations, but as well that fit the integrated systems test. Moreover, the Court of Appeals decision held that a product must be expected and intended to interact with the property it damages in order for the disappointed expectations test to apply. We believe that that conflicts with the Graham's decision. Graham's did not require that a product must be expected and intended to interact with the property it damages, and that focuses on the type of property damage as opposed to the risks that the parties to the contract contemplated at the time that the contract was entered into.
Mr. Gehring, I'm having a little trouble understanding how this water softener is part of an integrated system. Perhaps is part of an integrated system in regard to the plumbing, but how is it part of an integrated system in regard to the flooring, the walls, the ceiling, that sort of thing?
Well, the home as a unit is an integrated system. Mr. Kruger's State Farm's insured purchased this home. He started renovating with his son. He started a business to rent it out. As part of those significant renovations, they installed the water softener. They installed a new furnace in the home. They installed different components of the total home, which all formed one integrated system. And I think it is helpful, especially in response to some examples that were raised by State Farm, to realize that when you purchase the home, that a water softener would be considered a fixture, and it is part of that system of the home. It's part of the plumbing system, and the plumbing system is part of the home. And I think that it is consistent with Wisconsin law to apply the integrated systems test here and to not allow tort claims. But to the extent that there is confusion in applying the integrated systems test, as I read the Graham's decision, that is one reason why the disappointed expectations test was adopted. And under the disappointed expectations test under Graham's, it focuses on the risks that a reasonable purchaser should have contemplated at the time that they entered into contract for purchase of the product. And I believe in this case, the risk that a water softener might leak certainly is something that a reasonable purchaser should foresee when they purchase the product. A expectation for the performance of any piece of plumbing equipment that you purchase is that it will keep the water in it while it is performing whatever function it is, whether it's a pipe, a faucet, or any other part of your plumbing system. So I certainly think that that was a it was reasonably foreseeable that that type of malfunction could occur. I think that it's also helpful in applying the disappointed expectations test to take a look at two different prongs, I'll call it, to the test that in the Court of Appeals decisions that have discussed it, I think have come forward. The first that you need to look at is whether this particular malfunction is something that was reasonably foreseeable. And the Court of Appeals decision on that issue holds that it is not foreseeable to a reasonable purchaser that a water softener will leak. That's what it distills down to. They say in their decision.
Well, let me stop you right there. In regard to the disappointed expectation test, where is the focus supposed to be? Is the focus supposed to be on the risk, or is the focus supposed to be on foreseeability of what ultimately occurred? Where do you put the focus?
If I understand your question correctly, I think you're getting to the second prong of what I was saying. I think that, first of all, you need to look at the risk of this particular malfunction occurring. But the next step is you need to look at the risk that malfunction will cause the particular damage that occurred in the case. And I think in some of the examples that have been given throughout the cases and to this court in this case, it's helpful to analyze the disappointed expectations test under those two different prongs. As to the water softener, the first question is whether this leak was something that was reasonably foreseeable. And in order to meet the requirements of the disappointed expectations test, I believe that you need to say yes to both of those prongs. So first of all, a leak, it is reasonably foreseeable. Then you need to look at what happened as a result of that malfunction. Here there was damage to the home in which the water softener was installed. And again, it's reasonably foreseeable that if you're going to put a water softener in your home and it leaks, that it could damage the other components of your home. And I think this also furthers the policy goals of the economic loss doctrine in that risk of particular damage that the parties know or should have known at the time of contracting, those are the type of damages that you can negotiate about. You know at the time, you can obtain warranties regarding, and you can insure against. And that's why in this case, it is a relevant factor that State Farm's insured had a sufficient level of coverage to cover the damages caused in this case. He's the one who knew where this water softener would be placed. He knew the level of damage, economic damage that could occur if the water softener leaked. It did leak. He got coverage for that type of economic loss. And the system of contract law worked the way it should. And I don't see any reason in the circumstance of this case why tort law should trump contract law and the warranties and protections provided both to manufacturers and consumers under the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. And I would like to focus on the Court of Appeals decision because, as I stated...
What's the question here? The homeowners is covered, right? He's no longer in the case, right?
Correct.
So you sold the policy and took on this risk, right?
Well, State Farm sold the policy.
State Farm. Correct. And now State Farm is suing Hague, right?
Correct.
So why should State Farm shift a risk that it took to Hague?
Why should it shift a risk that it took to Hague?
It agreed to pay this risk. Why is it now trying to get somebody else to pay it?
Well, there are obviously principles of subrogation, and there certainly are covered claims that the law allows an insurer to subrogate against at-fault parties for. But the important factor here is that there was a contract that its insured had entered into, or a warranty, and this was for the purchase of a product protected by the UCC. So the important thing is that they're stepping into the shoes of their insured and their insured could not prosecute this claim or the tort claim based on the economic loss doctrine. So, I don't think that our position isn't that somehow subrogation should absolutely not exist in Wisconsin in any way. It's the particular facts of this case and that there was a contract, this was a good, and they're standing in the shoes of their insured. And the fact that there was insurance goes to as evidence, first of all, that in some ways this purchaser did foresee this risk. Not that he necessarily went out and bought the policy immediately after he purchased the water softener, but he had foreseen the risk of these type of damages occurring to his home. He knew the level of insurance to cover that type of risk, and he purchased it. And I think that does show that there was at least some foresight, or at least that reasonable purchasers, when they get this type of product, know that that's a type of damage that can occur to a home. And it does, again, further the goals, as I said. I think it's important that one of the goals is that the party best suited to assess the risk of economic loss is the one who allocates or insures against it. And here we don't know where this water softener would be placed. The manufacturer doesn't know where the water softener would be placed. It could be placed in a $1 million condo, and when it leaks, it damages and causes $1 million worth of damage. Or it could be placed in a modest lake home where it does not do significant damage. So if the Court of Appeals decision stands, it would place the manufacturer in the shoes of an insurer, essentially, because they could not limit the type of liability in contract that they try to do here with a limited warranty, because the purchaser could always circumvent that warranty through tort.
You resting on that limited, on the contract provision? Is that what you're resting on?
And I'm not sure I completely understand your question, Chief Justice.
Well, Hague had a contract, and it said it doesn't warrant against defects that injure other property.
They had a disclaimer of incidental and consequential damages.
Any of the damages. The warranty doesn't cover incidental, consequential, or secondary damages. Do you view the damage here as incidental, consequential, and secondary?
Well, I believe that it likely is consequential damages. And, in fact, the disappointed expectations test, as I pointed out by you in the dissent, looks at reasonable foreseeability, which is also generally a test in contract law. And, in fact, the UCC is broader than the general Hadley v. Baxendale test in that the UCC also allows for damages that are a result of a breach of warranty. So there I think, would be even additional damages. And that is the entire basis for our motion in this case. Our motion was to dismiss the tort claims because this case is more appropriately handled under contract law.
And the contract says this is consequential and therefore you're not liable.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. As to the Court of Appeals decision, I do want to point out the reasons why I think the test adopted in the Court of Appeals decision differs drastically from the test that was adopted by Graham's as to the disappointed expectations test. As to these two prongs that I've discussed already, the Court of Appeals decision, as I read it, says, as to the first prong, that the only thing a purchaser or a water softener reasonably foresees is that it will soften their water. And in other words, that the risk of a water softener leaking is not a contractual expectation of a purchaser of a water softener. And as I try to read it, I believe what they're attempting to do here is create some type of primary purpose rule where you look at what the primary purpose of a product is. But that conflicts with the general rule in discussing Graham's that looks at what the parties contemplated at the time that they entered into the contract as far as risks. It also, I think, conflicts directly with one of the cases that was approved in Graham's, which is the Seltzer decision, where windows were sold to a homeowner. They were represented to be treated to permanently resist rot. The homeowner installed the windows, and the windows, several years later, rotted, and then that rot spread to the siding of the home. Trying to apply the Court of Appeals decision in that case, I think, would lead to a different result on both of these prongs. First of all, what is the primary purpose of a window? It's certainly not to prevent rot on your siding. In fact, there wasn't even a specific representation made as to whether the rot would spread or not. It was just that it was treated to permanently prevent rot. In the Seltzer decision, the court actually held that there was no express warranty regarding whether it would rot in the future, because they just said it was permanently treated to treat rot. In any event, if you the primary purpose of a window is so that you can see out of a house, or potentially that you can open up the window to get some fresh air when the weather is nicer than it has been recently. Under the test adopted by the Court of Appeals, looking at the primary purpose, I think you'd have to say, well, the fact that this thing rotted and that spread to the siding, that really wasn't the reason why somebody goes and buys a window and puts it into their wall so they can see outside and that they can open the window. So I think that's a way, an example to look at how the disappointed expectations test in the Court of Appeals decision is not consistent with Graham's. Moreover, in the Court of Appeals decision, they said that a product must be expected and intended to interact with the property it damages. That goes to that second prong where you're asking, first of all, was this malfunction reasonably foreseeable? And again, in the case of water softener, I think it is reasonably foreseeable that it could leak, or at least that's a risk that's reasonably foreseeable. In the case of these windows, when they're represented to be permanently treated to resist rot, the fact they could rot and spread to the siding, that's reasonably foreseeable. The next question is the damage that was caused by this malfunction in the product something that was also reasonably foreseeable? Under the test adopted by the Court of Appeals, they say that the disappointed expectations test only applies when the product's expected and intended to interact with the drywall flooring, or in the case of the water softener, with the drywall flooring and woodwork that was damaged. In Seltzer, I don't think there was any allegation that the window was expected and intended to damage the siding that it did. And so, again, the Court of Appeals decision and the reason why we're here today and the reason why we petitioned this court to review the decision of the Court of Appeals is that it changed the test and no longer focuses on the risks as this court proclaimed in Graham's, and therefore we are asking this court to reverse that decision. And I do think it's also important to note that the trial court judge in this case, it was a fairly short oral decision, but the one thing that he said was, I read Graham's, this is like the case where the window rotted and spread to the siding. And our position is that it is that, and that the Court of Appeals erred in its ruling.
Where exactly would you change the Court of Appeals decision and state it properly? In other words, it's another way of asking one of my usual questions of how would you write this opinion? But I'd like you to focus on where you think they made the fatal error here.
Well, I'll leave the integrated systems analysis. I think they were incorrect in the integrated systems analysis. But as to the...
Well, that was in your favor, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't.
It was not in your
favor. It was not.
But you think that was okay?
No. I believe their recitation of the law was okay. I don't think they applied the law correctly.
Okay.
To the facts.
So the law is stated properly but not applied. Okay, that's
correct.
Fine. Where did they err in stating the law on disappointed expectations, which starts at paragraph 13.
Correct, and it begins right in paragraph 13.
Okay, tell us where the error is and how you would correctly state the law.
Sure. The first sentence of paragraph 13 is correct, and I believe is the disappointed expectations test. The second sentence where the court states, if a product is expected intended to interact with other products and property, that portion of it is incorrect and does not apply.
Paragraph 13, the next sentence says, under the disappointed expectations test.
Oh, I apologize. It's the second sentence that I think appropriately states the disappointed expectations test.
Tell me how you would change the sentence.
I would change the third sentence of paragraph.
The third sentence is if a product is expected and intended to interact with other properties, and that's a quote from Graham's.
Correct.
Do you have any objection to that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, what should it say?
I don't think that that needs to be there, in fact. I think that you can remove that clause of the sentence.
But is it error?
Excuse me?
Is it an error?
I do believe it's an error. I think it takes out of context, and specifically when it's applied to the facts of this case, I think it takes out of context the Graham's decision, which focuses on risk. In Graham's, at paragraph 47, there's a response being made to the party who didn't want the economic loss doctrine to apply, that the court should create a bright-line rule. And in the discussion of why a bright-line rule doesn't make sense, the court, as I read it, indicated that the integrated systems test in some ways is similar to the disappointed expectations test in that when a product is expected and intended to interact with other products and property, it's reasonably foreseeable that those products and property could be damaged. Okay. But when you read the entire decision, there's no requirement.
I'm willing to take out that if clause.
Okay.
Where else is there error in stating the law? Is it error to say if the cause of the damage to those other products and property stems from expectations, blah, 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 then recovery is precluded? Is that okay?
Yes, that is okay.
All right, let's go to paragraph 14. What in paragraph 14 is not okay in a statement of the law? I'm trying to get you to state your view of the correct law of disappointed expectations.
Well, I believe paragraph 14 is correct in its entirety.
Okay.
I believe 15 is, although I'm skimming it right now. I believe that's correct.
All right.
16 gets to the analysis, and I disagree with the analysis, although that's not a restatement of the law. That's an application.
This is the application of the law?
Correct.
Is that it?
Correct.
Disagree with application of the law.
17, I believe there was a... I believe there is a problem with that paragraph in that it uses the term foreseeable interaction and reasonable foreseeability in ways that had not been used by the Court of Appeals in decisions that it's discussing. There's an issue that...
17, foreseeability is not properly stated under the present law. I mean, well, that's what I hear you saying.
Correct. It certainly is a proper definition of foreseeable interaction, but I believe that the way it had been used in cases is not the way that it was being used in the opinion. In 18, paragraph 18, I think is an error of law altogether. I think it creates a different test. It actually applies the prior statements of what the law is on the disappointed expectations test to the facts of this case, but in doing so, it restates what I believe is the critical problem with the decision, and that is that it only focuses on the primary purpose of a product. And, you know, I'm not conceding either that a water softener's primary purpose is only to soften water. I think that it actually is a piece of plumbing equipment, and one of the primary purposes certainly is to keep water in it while it's moving water through your house. I do use an example at one point, which I think is somewhat helpful. And I think it's what State Farm argued and essentially was adopted, and that's that we sold a bag of salt. That's a different type of and situation where I think some of the arguments that State Farm has made makes more sense. If you buy a bag of salt, it might not be reasonably foreseeable that that could corrode your water softener and lead to damage and lead to leakage. But this wasn't a water softener in the way the term was being used by State Farm. It wasn't just some chemical that softens your water. This was a piece of plumbing equipment we cite in our reply brief to the definition of water softener, which defines it as an apparatus used to soften water, and that's what it was in this case.
Let me ask you this. What defect or what damage that the water softener causes, other than it doesn't soften the water? What damage that the water softener causes is covered under the economic loss doctrine, in your opinion? In other words, I'll state it differently. Can there be a suit for any damage other than that it doesn't perform its function? Do you know what I mean? I mean, here it leaks. Mm-hmm. It softens great, but it leaks, and you say that's not covered. So anything other than not softening the water, is anything else covered if it damages the basement or damages... Is it covered if it damages the plumbing?
I know the light's right. I assume you
have. You can answer my question.
I believe that by not covered, I think what you're saying is that the economic loss doctrine
right.
applies.
Right.
I think the economic loss doctrine would apply to any damage that was reasonably foreseeable, and to be more concrete in this circumstance, any damage to the components of the home certainly can said to be reasonably foreseeable to a purchaser, that those type of components of the home could be damaged. Certainly things that were surrounding it, and this water did leak. I mean, I think most people know where water can go when it leaks. And I think that, and briefly to discuss what I think you're getting at, there are some cases in the Court of Appeals that have created a stopping point. For example, there's a case, I believe it's Industrial Risk. It's a Quad Graphics case where there was a large building created for the printing at Quad Graphics, and there was a fire in it. And the smoke damaged neighboring buildings, and the disappointed expectations test was specifically discussed in that case. And the court said, look, damage to that structure may be still reasonably foreseeable, but once the smoke starts damaging other homes or other parts of, the parties argued that that was still an integrated system because it was one large factory, essentially. But once it starts damaging these other portions of the Quad Graphics facility, that no longer was reasonably foreseeable. So it's not a bright-line rule. But to give some examples, I do think other components of the home, certainly ones that water could leak and damage, are ones that that are reasonably foreseeable and that under the test they should be precluded in tort. And those are the type of damages also that in contract law the parties should reasonably know about, and those are the ones that you can negotiate regarding and protect against, and you can assess what type of damages is caused. And I know my time's off. There are some examples that maybe in rebuttal I'll bring up why I think that the rule, the way it's formulated, furthers the goals of the economic loss doctrine.
Thank you. Thank you. That, please. Mr. Kramer, representing State Farm, representing the homeowner's insurance.
May it please the court. I am Charles Kramer, and together with Monty Weiss, we represent State Farm Fire and Casualty in this company. We ask that this court affirm the Court of Appeals for one simple reason. We are not suing because the water softener failed to soften water. We are suing because the damages to our insured's home resulted from the flood, resulted from something that was unexpected, resulted from something that was not the function of the water. It resulted because the product was dangerous, unreasonably so, and damaged property. And that's the traditional concern of tort law.
Aren't these consequential damages, Counselor?
They are consequential damages under
the
contract.
All right, so we've got a contract that gives a limited warranty and says the maker of this piece of equipment is not going to pay for any consequential damages, right?
Correct.
That's a fact, okay?
In contract.
That's right, in contract. And so you think that you can now make them pay for consequential damages. That's what your suit's all about, right?
Your Honor, I believe that this is covered by tort law, and so in tort law, they're required to pay compensatory damages.
You may label it as you like, but the damages are consequential under the deal the parties made when this piece of equipment was purchased, correct? And you are standing in the shoes of the contracting party. So I don't quite know how you get out of those slippers and into tort law. You have to explain that to me.
Very good, Your Honor. Tort law deals with setting forth obligations that every manufacturer is supposed to make a reasonably safe product. Contract law says that it's up to the buyer to make sure that the product is reasonably suitable or secure a warranty if it's not. And this product was not a reasonably safe product for Mr. Krieger's other property.
Okay, could the purchaser of this water softener bring the same claim that you are bringing as an insurance company against the a person from whom they purchased it?
No. Well, they could. Excuse me.
I
apologize.
Standing in their shoes, then. I don't see how you can.
They could bring the same against as under products liability theory. they could bring the same tort claims. I misspoke. I apologize.
Okay, so you think that they can get out of the contract they made, which excluded what we agree are consequential damages under a theory of products liability?
Yes.
Okay, you want to explain to me how they could do that?
Because products liability, tort law says that everyone has to maintain a reasonably safe product. And this is not the contract that we did, if this isn't tort law, is not an exculpatory clause. This court has dealt with exculpatory clauses in the context of tort in the past.
Can you give me your definition of the economic loss doctrine then?
The economic loss doctrine exists depending on which test, but let's use the disappointed performance expectation test.
What's the economic loss doctrine do? Does it allow you to recover in tort things that you could contract for?
It says that damages where the product has lesser value because the product doesn't work for the general purposes for which it's purchased and sold are reduced to economic loss. That's what it covers. Anything outside of that is covered by tort law. And that's Wausau Tile, one of the first economic loss doctrine cases in this state.
But Wausau Tile was an integrated systems case. And if you look at it under Wausau Tile, what value independent does the water softener have aside from sitting in the house and softening the water?
Well, the value of it...
Why isn't it part of the integrated system of the house?
Shut off factually as a matter of shut off. It is not integral. It may be attached to certain parts, but it's not integral. The house functions perfectly well as a house, regardless of whether the water is hard or soft. It can be turned off by a valve or two, and the house continues to function.
I'm not asking about turning it off. I'm asking you, what value does it have if it's not part of the house? What value does it have?
It softens water, Your Honor.
It wasn't hooked to the house, who cares? If it's sitting in a showroom, it doesn't really give it a whole lot of value, does it?
It could be in a well house, in an outbuilding. Okay. And not in the house.
In this particular circumstance, under these facts, what value does this water softener have except to be part of this home?
It softens the water for the people in the home. But the other functions of the home, protecting from weather, keeping people warm, giving them shelter, it has nothing to do with that.
But the tile that was in Wausau Tile also had a limited purpose.
The cement in Wausau Tile was an integrated system because you had to put it in the tile to get the tile made. Here, homes exist. People are perfectly happy with hard water. It's an option.
Not many people in Wisconsin. You don't have to have one. You do not have to have one.
Your Honor, I would think that the prevalence of television sets in houses is much higher than that of water softeners.
I don't know. I don't think I've ever done a survey on it. But, you know, my concern is it seems to me twofold. Number one, you're trying to avoid the limited warranty that the party's contracted to, and you must stand in the shoes of a party in order to bring your suit. So I have difficulties with that because it's subrogation that you're seeking. And the second thing is, I, in my mind, can't perceive what else someone would want a water softener for except to have it hooked up to the water running through it in the house so it would soften the water. So if it doesn't have any value except to do what it was doing before it leaked, I don't know why it's not part of an integrated system, frankly.
The problem, I mean, we take a look, there's a couple questions there.
Okay.
Integrated system, we can look at it one way. We can look at it in terms of the contract. What did the people buy? What did they sell? Here there are two separate contracts. Mr. Krieger bought the house separately from the water softener. And if you're truly serious in the economic loss doctrine about preserving contractual expectations, you shouldn't mash together two contracts and then say anything about the expectations.
I haven't mashed together the two contracts. The only contract I would have you focus on is the one to purchase the softener.
Yes.
Okay. Let's just double back to the question that was asked. What is the economic loss doctrine? And I think that the answer to that question is that the economic loss doctrine bars recovery in a tort action for damages to the product itself, which would be the water softener, or monetary loss caused by the defective product. which does not cause personal injury. We're not arguing personal injury here. Okay. So you're barred from monetary loss caused by the defective product, which is the flooding, unless the damage is to other property.
Correct. Right?
That is the statement of the governing law, I think.
I would agree.
All right. The question in these cases then becomes, what is other property?
Correct.
One way of answering the question, what is other property, is whether it's the various properties at issue are integrated. So if they're integrated, then it's not truly other property, right?
Correct.
All right. So the question then is this integrated or not? You think it is, or you think it is or isn't?
It is not integrated.
It is not. You have to think that if you want the damages, right?
Correct.
Just want it to be other property. All right. The second test is this, I always forget how it's phrased, disappointed expectation test, right?
We believe it's a disappointed performance expectation test because really the risk is, what the risk we're addressing is the risk of non-performance or faulty performance on the part of the product.
Okay. We agree there's a contract here. We agree there's a privity between the insured and Hague, right?
For the purpose of that contract, yes.
And we agree that that contract has a disclaimer about consequential losses, right?
Correct.
And you've moved away from the contract because there's a doctrine in the law, in tort law, that says you put a product in the stream of commerce, and you can be liable for it.
Correct.
Strict product liability test. But the exception to that strict product liability test in Wisconsin is the economic loss doctrine, right?
Correct.
So that's how we get into economic loss doctrine. All right. So, frankly, I'm not sure I understand this disappointed expectation test. So, at least for me, you have to explain what it is and what are its elements and how they apply in this case. Okay.
Your Honor, what I would look at if I was in your position applying a disappointed expectation test.
I may have to write this opinion.
The disappointed performance expectation test. I would look for the reasons, the general reasons for which the property is purchased and sold.
All right. What is that?
Soft water.
Okay. It's sold to soften water. Okay.
And then I would
many a water softener I have purchased to soften water. Go
yes.
ahead.
All and right. then I would look at the damages caused by the failed product. Are the damages being claimed?
It was flooding. It leaked.
Correct. Are those result of the failure of the product to perform the general purposes for which it's bought and sold? It may have been perfectly soft water that flooded Mr. Krieger's home, but it's not because the water was too hard or too soft when it flooded the home that it caused the damages. So here we have a performance expectation that the water would be softened. And the damages have nothing to do with the failure of the product to live up to that performance expectation. The restatement talks about, at least in one place, the product being ineffectual, which would be covered by the economic loss doctrine, versus dangerous to other property.
What part of the restatement and what restatement are you making reference to?
It's the comments to Restatement 21 to the law of products liability.
Restatement first, second, or third?
I think it's the restatement of products liability. After second, they branch products liability off from.
I think that they labeled that third, but I know which. That's why I'm pinpointing which one they're doing. Okay, and what section are you referring to?
It's the comments to Section 21.
Okay, good. All right. And so you think under the restatement this is not barred by the economic loss doctrine?
Correct, because what we have here is a dangerous product, a product which is dangerous to other property. So, for example, if I have in Ford, State Farm versus Ford, we have a car or a truck that catches on fire. It only consumes itself. That's covered by the economic loss rule. But if the car is parked in a garage, it catches on fire and burns down the entire garage, no one would say that that's not a tort. no one would say that the economic loss, even though it was only property damage, would be barred by tort. Likewise, there's electricity powering this water softener. If Mr. Krieger's prize-winning German Shepherd had gone up to it and received a fatal electrical shock, no one again would say, well, wait, that's a tort.
Mr. Kramer, how does foreseeability get into all of this? Where does foreseeability fit as against risk?
I think the risk is the risk of non-performance of the product. So what happens is are the damages foreseeable if the product fails to perform either its essential functions or as advertised? So in Seltzer, we have the situation where the product fails, it's advertised as rot resistant. What is the risk if it fails in its rot resistance? Well, the windows and the surrounding timber rots. In Grams, the risk is that the milk replacement fails to be nutritious to cows, and so the cows sicken and die. Spicella, I think, which was also cited in Grams, illustrates the difference pretty well. In Spicella, the farmer buys a chemical to treat his seed potatoes to prevent them from rotting. The chemical is actually effective in preventing the potatoes from rotting, but it also kills the potatoes. And so the Court of Appeals, and this court said that, you know, if it had examined it, it may turn out the same way. The Court of Appeals said, look, the expectation, the performance expectation, is that the potatoes won't rot. Well, they didn't. What happened is, instead, they were killed. In this case, if we were here because Mr. Krieger's whites were not as white after washing, if the brights were not as bright as they should have been after washing, if his pipes had filled up with lime deposits, if he had to use more soap to clean his shower.
But, Counselor, doesn't that all just tie up with your idea of failure? I mean, you say the only way the water softener can fail is not to soften the water.
Correct. It does fail.
No other way could this product fail.
Well, it could fail in a myriad of ways. The question is, which ways does the economic loss doctrine permit suit and which does it not? So the question, what I'm saying is, if it fails as a water softener by not removing enough calcium, leaving lime deposits, letting the lime fill up pipes, those are consequential damages which are barred by the economic loss doctrine because the product is not functioning as a water softener. If, however, to use my other example earlier, the dog brushes up next to it and receives a fatal electric shock, that's a tort because the product is unreasonably dangerous to other property.
You think a water softener that leaks is unreasonably dangerous product? That's what I'd have to agree with, right, if I agreed with you?
I believe that it is an unreasonably dangerous product. In this case, it caused $44,000 in damage to a home.
It may cause a lot of monetary damages. I'm not sure that that's necessarily the definition of unreasonably dangerous, but that is the one that you hang your hat on, correct?
It has to be
unreasonably dangerous to fit within your construct.
It has to be unreasonably dangerous to cause a tort in the first place.
Well, I think torts are caused by a lot of things that are not unreasonably dangerous, Counsel.
Well, I think we could debate the actual elements, but I think the general element of negligence and products liability is unreasonable conduct on the part of somebody.
With an unreasonably dangerous product.
Okay.
Products liability would be an unreasonably dangerous and defective product. Okay. That's a tort.
And that would be unreasonably dangerous to people, individuals, personal safety, as well as, you were saying, property safety.
Correct. So, for example, if the water softener had exploded and chunks had fallen through my neighbor's house, although it would only be property damage, we wouldn't have a question about it.
Counselor, what if this water softener leaked and it caused $15 worth of damage because the owner walked in, saw it, and he just had to hire someone to come in and clean up the basement? Or maybe it cost $50 to come in and clean up the basement. Would the product still be unreasonably dangerous when it leaked?
It very well could be, but I think that would be more of a question for a jury.
Same product, Counselor, same product.
If the failure mechanism was such that a consumer in looking at it would view the product as being unreasonably dangerous and defective, yes. Now, with $15 damage, we may not even be seeing a suit. Probably wouldn't see an insurance company.
But we still have the same analysis, or I would have the same analysis when I looked at this product. Is the product unreasonably dangerous? You're telling me it is because it costs $41,000. But if the same water softener leaked and cost $50 for someone to come in and clean up the basement, then maybe not. I mean, I guess that's what I understand you to say.
Yes. We have alleged that the product is unreasonably dangerous in our complaint. That was not the focus of the summary judgment motion here. And so for the purposes of this case, the court has to accept that it is an unreasonably dangerous product.
Unreasonably dangerous is kind of a term of art for products liability.
It is.
Yes. I mean, that's the phrase that's used, whether or not it is the kind of thing that would be considered a spiked projectile going towards children. Now, that would be unreasonably dangerous, but it's a term of art used in products liability.
Correct. It would be unreasonably, in this case, we believe it's unreasonably dangerous to other property.
There's been some discussion about the warranty and consequential damages. If the court would decide that based on the warranty that you cannot collect, that the homeowner could not collect consequential damages, and that since you are standing in the shoes of a homeowner, that you also, based on the warranty, cannot collect consequential damages, then you don't even get to an economic loss doctrine analysis, it seems to me. Am I wrong or am I correct?
Well, I think you have to do the economic loss doctrine to bar the tort claims. I think the tort claims are there. They've been presented. If the contract, there are exculpatory contracts in tort. I don't think anyone argues that this would be an valid exculpatory contract, but it may be a valid limitation of warranties under the UCC. So if the cause of action sounds in tort, then the contract can't be considered because it's not a valid exculpatory contract. Now, Hague could have written perhaps a valid exculpatory contract, or the parties could have negotiated a valid exculpatory contract, but that's not what we have here. We have a warranty that came packaged in a box, and no one would say it would be a valid exculpatory contract under this court's law.
On the issue of foreseeability, in paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals opinion, it states that Hague's argument is misplaced, that it confuses reasonable foreseeability with foreseeable interaction, contrary to Foremost One case cited at 297 with Second 274, paragraph 20. Can you further explain what the Court of Appeals meant by that?
I think the Court of Appeals looks at foreseeability in terms of any tort law. Foreseeability is an element of negligence. If I have to prove a cause of action in negligence, it has to be foreseeable. Under the new statutory definition of products liability, two of the three ways I get to recovery, foreseeability is an element. So let's say this was a purely negligence action. If I prove that it was foreseeable, not only have I proved my cause of action in tort, but I've proved the absolute defense to it. And so it really would wipe out tort law if the question was foreseeability. So the Court of Appeals looks at foreseeable interaction. Is it foreseeable that these two pieces of property would interact, which is a direct quote from Graham's, as the starting point to see if the economic loss doctrine applies. I think a better way of looking at it is what is the risk that we look at? The foreseeability is the risk of non-performance by the product. And that's in the case law as well, that we look to see under the economic loss doctrine what happens. Is this part of the risk that if the product doesn't perform as it should? For example, if my car doesn't start in the morning this morning and the court sanctioned me for not appearing, that would certainly be a damage, but that would be because the car failed of its essential purpose. The risk I take in owning a car is that one day it might not start. If, however, on my way home, when I get home tonight, my car crashes through my back garage wall or through my living room because the brakes fail and the steering fail, that's a tort, and I'm entitled to collect that property damage from the manufacturer of my car if I can show that the manufacturer committed a tort.
You answered my question by, it seems to me, replacing foreseeability vis-a-vis the risk of performance or non-performance with the words of the Court of Appeals, which is foreseeable interaction. So their analysis is exactly what you're talking about with regard to that language, it seems to me. Push back if I'm wrong on
that. No, I think I do differ a little bit, because if you look at the doctrinal basis for the economic loss doctrine, it's that the product doesn't function for the general purposes for which the product is manufactured and sold. And so I think if we talk about foreseeability, you talk about foreseeability of anything, because after all, lots of things are foreseeable in hindsight. So it may be foreseeable now that Ford Motor Vehicles, after Ford, State Farm versus Ford and General Casualty Ford, that Fords catch fire. If a Ford now is parked in my garage and it of that same make and model and catches fire that I may have bought after State Farm came down used, is that now a foreseeable risk? Really what we need to look at is foreseeability that the product will not function in the purposes for which the product is bought or sold. And I think that's the central idea of the economic loss doctrine, certainly the failed performance expectation test. That's what we look at. In terms of the integrated system test, opposing counsel mentions the law of fixtures as somehow controlling the case. But the law of fixtures doesn't control the case. It doesn't control whether something's integrated. The mailbox post in my front yard is a fixture of the land. Fixtures is not developed to sell real estate. It's not to sell houses. We sell real estate in the United States, in this state, by saying that I sell to you and then I do the property description of that real estate. And anything affixed that's a fixture to that, it goes with the sale. But it doesn't mean that anything that's a fixture is necessarily integrated for the purposes of the economic loss doctrine. Here we have a product that can be shut off easily by the flick of two switches from the house. Attached does not mean integrated. Integrated has some component of integral. Is the water softener integral to the functioning of the house? Here it is not, because people have houses without water softeners. And the water softener, it's anticipated by Hague that the water softener can be shut off and that the people in the house can function just as easily with perhaps slightly harder water. This is not an integrated system. The other way of looking at the integrated system, the way that the federal courts do in Admiralty under Saratoga, is to look at the contracts between the parties. What was purchased by the buyer? That's something that this court looked at in Linden. And so what the courts there do is look, what's the contract between the parties? Here we have two separate contracts. We have the contract for the purchase of the home. We have the contract for the purchase of the property. And if we want to preserve the sanctity and freedom of contracts, then we shouldn't mash two unrelated contracts together, two contracts with parties that are not even in privity. Rather, if we're going to seek a background law to contracts, if we're going to overturn contractual expectations, what better background law to look at than the law that we've already developed, the law of torts? So if we use in the integrated system the federal analysis of looking either Justice Breyer, the last manufacturer, the last distributor in the chain, or Justice Scalia, or even of the Court of Appeals in Saratoga, what did the buyer actually buy? This is not an integrated system. In fact, that may be a better test in looking at integrated systems than going through minute factual digging into how the products function together.
So you're applying the Graham's test as follows, if I understand you. The economic loss doctrine applies, so that bars recovery, when, quote, prevention of the subject risk, that's flooding here, was one of the contractual expectations motivating the purchase of the defective product. So they weren't motivated to buy a leak preventer or a flood preventer.
Correct.
They were motivated to buy a water softener that
Correct.
Softens water. Therefore, they didn't expect they didn't buy it to stop leakage. Therefore, they've passed the disappointed expectations test because they didn't contract for a leak preventer. The damage here had nothing to do with its water softening ability, which they did expect. No party disputes that it had anything to do but a fine softening job. That's your test.
Correct.
Now, Graham's does not set forth the disappointed expectations test the same way everywhere. That's one of the little problems, in my opinion.
Grams is not, there are sentences in Grams that could be read out of context that would conflict with other parts of Grams. But I think really looking at Grams as a whole, you have to look at the reason for which the product is bought or sold. In this case, it's a water softener. If it's beyond that, then tort law applies, because everyone in Wisconsin has the obligation, if they're a producer of products, to produce a reasonably safe product.
Well, you know, the manual here did caution that the softener could cause leaks. And it did say it had a valve system that was designed to prevent that. Oh, and very frankly, which has nothing to do necessarily with the case, but the reasonable person is always the judge, right? Hey, if I think it's reasonable, everybody else thinks it's reasonable. And I would expect anything connected to plumbing has the potential to leak, right? Because you got water in there, so something's going to go wrong. It's going to be a crack in the cylinder. One of the hydrants or hoses is going to turn loose in something or other. So I have a hard time in saying that their expectation here was, you know, that it might flood, it might leak.
Well, I think there is a difference between a flood and a leak. There's a difference between a drip, drip, drip and a flood that comes out of the room, across the hall, and comes pouring out of the walls of the garage, as Mr. Krieger testified to. In addition, the manual that we're talking about was with the packaging of the water softener. There's no indication that Mr. Krieger saw the manual, read it, before purchasing the product so as to form his performance expectations. The fact that, as I mentioned, the Ford vehicle may catch fire, and anyone reasonable to read the opinions of this court, the fact patterns, knows that two cases of this court, State Farm and General Casualty versus Ford, vehicles caught fire because of bad switches. But if I have one of those same vehicles parked in my house or parked in my garage, it catches fire, the fire spreads to my entire house, burns it to a cylinder, I should be able to recover in tort, especially if the warranty has already expired or disclaims consequential damages. The reason that we have products liability is because this court viewed it as being insufficiently protective in contract, the law, the prior law, of being insufficiently protective in contract. And so we have torts like products liability. We have torts like negligence. And everyone is required under that to behave reasonably, for reasonably safe products. I see that my time has expired.
Where's any other questions? Counsel, thank you. Mr. Gehring, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to address a couple of issues raised by State Farm's counsel. First of all, as to foreseeable interaction and reasonable foreseeability, I think we actually agree on that fact. My client's position certainly is that there is a reasonable component to the disappointed expectations test. The paragraph in the Court of Appeals decision, and I did mention that I disagreed with it, I thought foreseeable interaction was being used incorrectly. The Court of Appeals indicates that Haig is taking the position here that because this it was foreseeable that it could leak, conceivable in some way, conceivably foreseeable, that it's Haig's position that the disappointed expectations test should apply. That's not our position. We're saying that it's reasonably foreseeable from a purchaser's perspective that a water softener could leak and it could damage the other components of the home. The citation to Foremost One in the Court of Appeals decision as well, the context in which foreseeable interaction came up in Foremost One was a party argued that the statement in the Grams decision that if a product is expected and intended to interact with other property, it naturally flows that when it damages that other property, the expectations of the purchaser are disappointed. That means that whenever property is expected and intended to interact with other property, the disappointed expectations test applies. And what Foremost One said is, no, that's focusing on foreseeable interaction. That's looking at this whether it's expected and intended to interact with other property, and that is not the appropriate test under Grams. The appropriate test is what was reasonably foreseeable, not simply whether it could have come in contact in some way. So Haig was not taking the position, and never has, that because the water softener in some way was expected and intended to interact with the drywall and other components of the home, the disappointed expectations test should apply. In fact, we're taking the opposite position, which is the reason why the disappointed expectations test should apply is because it was reasonably foreseeable to a purchaser that this type of damage could happen and that this type of risk was inherent in the purchase of the product, and that the type of damage that occurred is the type that they knew of or could have known of at the time that they entered into the contract and either bargained for or insured against, which in fact they did in this case. I also mentioned at the end of my discussion that there were a couple of examples, and they were raised during opposing counsel's presentation. And I think, again, both parties agree that the question for the court here is, as to the disappointed expectations test, how do we determine what is reasonably foreseeable? And those two prongs that I discussed earlier, when applied to the examples that have been given, are almost always consistent. The example given by counsel of the vehicle that lurches backwards and runs into the garage, again, is the vehicle lurching backwards something that's reasonably foreseeable to a purchaser? Probably is. I think there could be some argument on that, but it probably is. Now, is it reasonably foreseeable that it's going to damage your garage, or what type of damage does that type of malfunction, going to cause? That's not the same type of thing that you can assess in the way that you can assess what damage a water softener is going to do when it leaks. You could park in a parking lot in front of a million-dollar sports car, and it could lurch backwards, and it could do damage to that vehicle. So I think that example is one time where, on that second prong, whether it was reasonably foreseeable that this product could cause that damage, the test might actually provide that it was not reasonably foreseeable.
Counsel, I want to just tweak what you're saying a little bit. Are you then saying that it's reasonably foreseeable when you purchase a water softener that it will malfunction, that is, leak, and reasonably foreseeable that it will, as a consequence of the malfunction, cause damage to other property as it did here?
Absolutely, that's correct.
I don't know how reasonable I am, so I'm not sure I'm the reasonable person, but when I buy a water softener, I hope I replace it before the bottom rusts out and before it malfunctions. And if I don't, I hope my husband does. I don't know if when I buy a water softener, I anticipate that it's going to cause damage to the carpet in the rec room and damage the drywall of the walls. I just don't know if that's reasonably foreseeable. That's what I expect. So can you help me with that? Because it seems to me that's what you're saying.
Well, and I think that that is why the integrated systems test is helpful in looking at the disappointed expectations test as well. Components of your home, when one component of your home fails, my understanding of the integrated systems test is that courts have determined as a matter of law that it would be reasonably foreseeable that it could damage other components of the home. And
I don't know if it's that broad, but go ahead.
Well, I think the same rationale is there. And these were, and I think when it gets tied back to the actual policy goals of the economic loss doctrine, it makes sense as well. Again, these are the type of damages. You know where you're going to put your water softener. You know what type of damage could cause. You're the person best situated to assess that type of risk. And in fact, again, homeowners go out, and most of them, and buy homeowners insurance to protect themselves from these type of risks of a sufficient level to cover the damage that's caused if there is this type of malfunction in the home. So again, I think in this circumstance, the fact that there is an insurance company sitting here that paid for this and now is now subrogated to the insured's claim, and that the insured has no claim of his own and presumably should have been added if he did have a claim of his own as a necessary party, shows that the system is working the way it should. And in this circumstance, there's no reason to circumvent the party's agreement and to allow the tort law to trump contract law.
Let me say in connection with these questions depends on which part of Graham's you read. At its narrowest statement, I think it says that the disappointed expectation test bars recovery in tort when the only damages claimed derive from, and this is the language, quote, the level of performance of the manufacturer's products in the consumer's business, and that means failed performance. So if you take that, you can interpret it to mean this softener was designed and intended and foreseen to soften water. And then the result is it's disappointed because it softens the water but does something else. So it's narrow. But a slightly broader interpretation, which is in paragraph 47, is if a product is expected and intended to interact with other products, it naturally follows that the product could adversely affect and even damage that property. It's a slightly different test.
I agree. My understanding of that paragraph is it was in response to creating a bright line rule. And if I may, just one last thing, it is directly in response to what you just said. You know, I think that raises, well, first of all, I take issue with the argument that State Farm has made that a water softener is only designed to soften water, not to keep it in it while it's doing its function. But to the extent that Graham's is not clear, it did clearly approve the Seltzer decision. And if you're going to say here that this, if the basis for the ruling is going to be that the reason why this is not a disappointed performance expectation is because this product was not intended to be a leak preventer, certainly the window was not intended to be something that prevented rot from getting on the siding. In fact, just don't put a window in if you want to prevent that type of risk. It was a malfunction in the way that the window achieves its goal of letting you see
through
it and open it up.
The evidence in that test was that they had that in mind of preventing rot. The evidence in that case was that they had in mind preventing rot around the window.
From the window.
And so it's arguable that there was a special expectation. But anyway, Graham's has some issues as to which part of Graham's you apply, in my opinion. And I gather you don't disagree that there are different ways of stating the disappointed expectation test.
I don't disagree, but I think in the end that the decision focuses on the risks, and that is the reason why we asked the court to reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel on yet an economic loss doctrine case. We've had quite a number, and I think as the commentators view us as having a very broad economic loss doctrine in the state. That ends our hearing on 12-18-392, State Farm Fire and Casualty Company versus Hague Quality Water International. The court is in a recess in its oral arguments, but completed its oral arguments for today. The court will meet in conference at 1:45. We are in recess.